Welcome to Fossils by Firelight, a series of conversations with South Africa's geological legends, where they unearth their discoveries, learnings, memories, interesting stories, and maybe a few tall tales to chronicle our history and inspire the next generation of geological heroes.
Hello, welcome to another Fossils by Firelight series. This one titled The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, with some legends. I won't call them fossils, but some distinguished gentlemen in the platinum industry.
Our first guest today is Gordon Channett. The fellows for the GSSA will know him well for his really bad jokes. For me, Gordon is the guy most likely to drop me in it. Let me explain. During COVID, the GSSA did a load of talks every day. In fact, we did a couple of talks a day sometimes, didn't we, Sofiso? And one day I got this phone call from a total random stranger shouting at me because our talk was at the same time as theirs. So I'm like, who are you? And it's like, oh, Gordon said that you're the person to shout at. It's actually led to a really good friendship between us. But yeah, thanks, Gordon. But a little bit more about Gordon. He's been boss of G Channett Consulting for 15 years, but before that, spent 30 years with Anglo Platinum and America.
Yeah. My career in platinum started way back in about 1981, when JCI had a funny division. They had several very successful divisions, the gold probably being the most well-known, but their property division was also very well-known. They had base metals and coal and other things, and then they had this very strange division that they didn't really know what to do with, and it was called the platinum division. They had huge number of resources in the eastern bushveld that they had no clue on what they had, other than that there was known to be a trace of the Merensky Reef because Merensky himself had traced it out. But very little work had been done subsequent to the 1929-1930 discovery of platinum. And part of my very early job was to drill holes on both Merensky and the UG2 to intersect it at below the weathering zone, preferably below 100 meters, and to effectively trace out the contours of the Merensky and UG2 with a view to the first attempt at evaluating and putting a value on some of the farms that we owned in the eastern bushveld. So as a result, I spent 4 years, I think it was, based at a little mine called Driekop, which had five or six houses, and only two houses were occupied, my house and the guy who maintained the pumps. We were in the middle of Lebowa, in the middle of nowhere, and it was positively the most happy time of our bush career, if I can put it that way. We had a ball. It was fantastic. We had local communities that we helped, and they helped us. It was a wonderful synthesis of getting to know people and communities. There are lots of stories I could ramble on about, but one in particular was a piece of machinery broke on one of the drill rigs, and I ran to the nearest mine with this piece of machinery and said, please, could one of your guys weld it? And the artisan grabbed it from me, ran off to his bench and welded it. When he returned, I said, well, what do I owe you? And his words were that I had been helping the community. I was a brother to them. He'd be a brother to me. That was just one of the many incidents that we had that was wonderful to be in the bush. I then moved in 84 to end of 84 to Rustenburg. There was a downturn in the platinum price and everything closed. So I was sent to the mines, which I actually enjoyed. And people think of the mines as being drudge. I thoroughly enjoyed the 7 years that I spent on Rustenburg. I learned a lot. I learned a lot about structures of companies, much more than I'd ever known before. I enjoyed the experience of working underground because up till then, you'd been dealing with a piece of round core, maybe half a meter long, and you're trying to visualize what the ore body looks like between this little piece of core, 30-odd millimeters in diameter, to another piece of core 1 kilometer apart. And it was difficult to visualize what the ore body would be like. Underground, you could see it in 3D. You could walk into stopes and crosscuts intersect the reef and get a complete visualization of what's going on and what are the structures within the reef that you need to be able to characterize. More importantly, what the people were. And I remember with great fear and trepidation as a very young geologist approaching the Mine Managers Association in Rustenburg at one of their meetings with the intention of starting a branch in the Northwest. I think we called it Northwest Bushveld or Western Bushveld Geological Branch of the GSSA. And I was quizzed on, but what do you want to do? Are you going to talk about ore reserves? And what is the Impala guys going to learn from us? And how are we going to keep things secret? And it was a devil of a job to try and convince the Mine Managers Association that we wanted to exchange matters of geological interest and to go and visit other things like the iron ore mines at Tabazimbi, like the diamond mines at Swartruchans, the chrome mines. Many of us had never seen any of those. Eventually, we got permission to start that branch, and I was happy to be part of that for a great many years, and still I receive their notifications. I think that branch is probably one of the more successful sub-branches of the GSSA, and I'm very proud to have been part of that exercise.
As I famously call you, as you are an uncle, and you are talking around, you know, matters of geological interest, some of the things you are involved in include the fellows. You still continue to train some of the youngsters, up-and-coming geologies, which we'll get onto a bit later. I'd like for now to come to our next speaker, Dennis Hoffman, who's the MRM manager at Northern Platinum, who also, like, she started off in gold, but then found his, what I think is his love in platinum. So can you just tell us about your journey, how it started off getting into the platinum industry?
Well, it's been a long journey to get there. I started in platinum probably one third of my way into my career. The start off was with Goldfields of South Africa. And the beauty with Goldfields is they gave you this variety of experience like Gordon alluded to. There was base metals, there was gold, an opportunity to go to Ghana. And then eventually they were looking for a senior geologist at Zondereinde mine. And nobody wanted to go there because it was a tough mine. And it's always been a tough mine. And I was thrilled to be able to go there. And that's where I started my platinum mining. And the experience that one picked up there was none that anybody else had had. The depth of mining, they started at 1.3 kilometers and mined up to 2,000 meters below surface. Now, the amazing thing, at 2 kilometers in the bushveld, your geothermal gradient is hovering around about 55 degrees at that point. So it was a challenging environment, but nonetheless, the beauty of Zondereinde was all the innovation that they brought to the table with the hydropower. We used hydropower for diamond drill machines. We used it for rock drill machines. And the real winner from the hydropower was the chilled water that kept the temperature in the workplaces to a reasonable ambient temperature. So working at Zondereinde was a start. I was only there for 3 years, and then I left for Botswana for 10 years, which was really part of the highlight of my career. But nonetheless, 6 years in Celebi Piqui on a nickel copper mine over there called BCL, and then moved on to diamond brownfield exploration at Jwaneng. And I think the Jwaneng must have been the highlight of my career because it was so important to understand what those kimberlite pipes looked like down at depth. And the interest was there from, obviously, from Depswana, the Botswana government, who was a major shareholder. They were interested. De Beers were interested. So that was a little bit of a side thing. But eventually it got to the time when the family needed to move back to South Africa, and I joined Lonmin Platinum. And Lonmin was at the peak of the boom. And that's what I would say is when we talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly, the good is those peak times in the platinum mining. And there was one peak that I recall from 2003 to 2007. And then I joined at the tail end of that peak. And from then it was almost downhill for a long time before the platinum mines came out of that rut. But after 11 years with Northam, I was lured back to Northam Platinum again. And it's been wonderful to be back at the Zondereinde mine. I have a role also within the group services that looks after the Booysendal operation on the Eastern Limb. And we have the Eland mine outside Brits, and that's where we're based. So in terms of platinum mining stories, well, there's plenty of them to go on, but I'll share that one for a little bit later on.
Thank you, Dennis. And yeah, you are working on what is now referred to as a new age, you know, platinum mining, interesting project. And we'll bring that back when we look into the future and more importantly, you know, opportunities for the young ones and specifically in platinum. Now on that, I'd like to introduce someone. It sounds like you have worked with Dennis previously, who started off also at gold, then went into platinum before venturing off to consulting, where he consults for platinum and various other commodities. Another friend of the society, like the other two gentlemen here, who we always coerce to get involved, been involved from the SAMREC side of things, past chair, representativity on Crisco. We'll get onto that later. But what are some of your platinum stories and the journey? Ken Lomberg, directed Pivot Mining.
Thanks, Afisa. I thought you'd forgotten my name for a moment.
So did I.
So probably my interest in platinum started while I was studying. Igneous petrology was definitely something that tweaked my interest. So I was always looking to get involved in anything that related to igneous rocks. And then my second year, I did inorganic chemistry. And the transition metals, which is where all the PGMs are, tweaked my interest as well. So it was probably fateful that eventually I would end up involved in platinum somewhere along the line. But as you said, I got a bursary from Goldfields, was obliged to work for them for 4 years, which I did. And the month after my contract expired, I disappeared overseas. I spent a year traveling, and before I'd left, I'd put my CV together and put it in envelopes with stamps and everything and told my parents, I will phone you and tell you when to post them. So sometime in November that year, they posted 30 or 40 applications to everybody and anyone for a job. So I arrived back in December that year and managed to get a few interviews. And then early the following year, which was 1990, I got a job with what was then Genmin. And so that started my job as an exploration geologist in platinum. I probably wasn't terribly good at the time. I probably learned a huge amount in a very short time. But it was logging core, managing drill rigs, going out to these remote places, finding places to stay, things that we've all done before, and then suddenly having to manage a drill rig and a very difficult driller who didn't want to know anything and was quite happy to produce core that was substandard. So all of those experiences were fantastic, getting to know the local community, meeting the chiefs, having to go and talk to them and convince them that we're not doing anything terrible. So that was exploration, particularly out on the Western Limb, out on the other side of the Pilansberg. So that was a fantastic start. But with the downturn in, would that have been the mid-90s, then I was retrenched. But Anglo, and I don't know whether Gordon was even involved, rescued me, and I ended up as a mine geologist at Turfontein. That happened for a few years, and then they were looking for someone to go to Union Section. So I was posted off to Union Section, which was also a great experience. And there was introduced to a number of people and really enjoyed that. And let me go back a moment and say that when I was with Gencore, I managed to score a trip to Brazil and lived in Brazil for 6 months on other layered intrusions. So the Nicolandia and Barro Alto intrusions. So I learned a whole lot more there that I probably would not have learned otherwise. So after being retrenched, I worked with at Turfontein and then at Union, and then managed to score the job as the first geologist at Rasimoni. So I walked into the Rasimoni on probably a Monday morning, I would guess, and I'd been told that I would sort of arrive and go to HR and stuff, but that didn't happen. The mine manager or the production manager grabbed me by the collar, marched me all the way down to what was a south shaft, and I saw a big excavator digging a trench. And he said to me, "Where is the Marensky Reef?" And I knew instantly that my reputation was at stake. If I didn't make it, I was going to be trashed. But thanks to Gordon, in a very unusual event, probably about 2 or 3 months before, on a Saturday afternoon, the two of us went down one of the Rasimoni shafts that had just got to reef. So we went down, and I saw the reef, and I got some introduction to the geology. And the most important was that the Bastard Reef and the Marensky were 9 meters apart. So in this trench, and you can imagine a 30-ton excavator digging a trench, it goes rapidly. So I eventually stopped it and walked up and down the trench, found the Bastard, and then found the Marensky and saved my reputation at that moment. So I worked for Rasimoni and then got retrenched again. Strange that. I'm hoping that that wasn't fatal, but it wasn't. Ended up in a consulting company called RSG Global, which has morphed into a number of companies. And in being with RSG Global and Coffee Mining and now Pivot Mining, I've had the opportunity of visiting almost every project and mine on the Bushveld at some stage, which has been a fantastic situation. But I've also had the luxury of going to Zimbabwe to the Great Dyke. I've been involved in projects in Australia, Cal Platts, which is also a platinum-hosted deposit. So I really have had a fantastic variety of exposure to platinum. It's been absolutely wonderful, and it continues to this day.
So Cal Platts was my only find ever. I was working for Cal Gold. We were looking for more gold, and we found Cal Platts.
Hallelujah.
I know.
All right, back to UMG. You were mentioning Bush Career, and, you know, I mean, what are some of the interesting things? Ken touched on them around platinum, you know, with the reefs, the stars. I'm sure there's the potholes, the geological, so to speak, potholes. But what are some of the challenges, you know, throughout your career that and some of the things that interest you within the platinum industry for, you know, a new up and coming geologist, just so they appreciate how it was and what's going forward, what that will look like and the potential as well?
Safisa, I'm going to come back to your question, but start with dealing with something that Ken alluded to, and that is that the cyclical nature of the platinum market and the effect that that has on the industry, because that, I think, was a huge driver. Barry Davidson in JCI said we need to halt the hiring and firing because they were out of phase. They would be firing people just as the market would be turning and becoming positive again, having recklessly survived a downturn. And he needed to build a war chest. And he said, how do we do it? We need to understand where our resources are. And how do we do that? We need exploration. So I think that was a great visionary comment. Yeah, exploration was a great love of mine. I did end up having control of all the mines in Anglo Platinum at one point in my career. But the great love that I had was exploration. And all over the world, I had a very simple strategy, and that was, if platinum occurs anywhere on the planet, I want to have the first chance of either buying it or holding it and keeping it out the hands of competitors so that we could command the market, which we held very firmly for a very long time. And so I was privileged to travel all over the world and have projects in a number of countries. And it was interesting to compare the working styles of different communities. We have projects in China, in Russia, in several places in Russia, in Canada, in Brazil, and of course in Zimbabwe. I must say that I thoroughly enjoyed working in Zimbabwe and initiating the Unki mine, or being part of the team that initiated the Unki mine. The guys that worked there worked under enormously difficult circumstances where you have to barter beer. Can you imagine having to barter beer for sugar? And fuel. You'd have to barter beer for fuel. And luckily, we had a reasonable store of beer. But that's geological planning, of course. Then establishing the mine and getting the underground workings going, and an ore body that is so difficult to see, bringing in an instrument that could pick up copper and nickel, and by proxy, you can pick up where the best potential position of the MSZ, the main mineralized zone, would be. And using that as a mapping tool in an underground situation, I think that was great. It was great for innovation. Likewise, we took instruments to China, and we found that they were using Soviet-era analytical techniques. These needed to be modernized. They didn't understand how or what they needed to do. So it was an education process as much as a quality control process. I must say that even despite the old optical instruments that they were using, they were reasonably accurate in giving platinum assays. So I give them credit where credit is due, but they needed modernization.
So Gordon, just to jump in there, I had a really interesting experience recently. One of my Canadian colleagues through Crisco was telling our audience very publicly, why did platinum people add platinum, palladium, rhodium, and gold? Clearly, it was the wrong thing to do. And he did it a whole number of times. And I had to go to him very quietly and say, originally in the platinum business, we had to have the lead prill. And because that was the only thing that we could get the numbers from, we had to use the 3PGE plus gold number. It was only recently that we've had the luxury of nickel sulfide or silver or palladium collectors giving us all the different elements. So I see that the technology has really moved on and made things fantastic. And now whenever we talk to people about exploration, we say nickel sulfide, you've got to do all 4 PGEs. And sometimes they do all 6, obviously, just to make it much more interesting.
Yeah, it's a valuable comment, Ken.
Gordon, you probably found a lot of interesting people because that was my experience in platinum, you know, from the senior managers right the way through to the stope observers and the interesting characters that you come across. And one of the stories that I have is about the stope observers that would go into workplaces and would have to report on unplanned dilution or unnecessary overbreaking. So they were not favorite people. And the one guy came to me and he said, the job that he does, he's hated by everybody. And he doesn't mind hated by other people, but he wants to be hated for something. He doesn't want to be hated for nothing. So please increase my salary. but getting back to something you said earlier on about confidentiality of information, and I think you must recall the only people that knew the grade on the mine was the chief surveyor and the mine manager. Everybody else in the early days were kept in the dark. And I think maybe the Met manager would have known as well. But everybody else didn't know what the broken grade is. They didn't know what the mole grade is. They just knew, well, how many centers and were you on reef? Times have changed significantly since then.
I can build on that. And that is that in the drilling in the Eastern Bushveld, I was not privy to the results of the borehole other than that, yes, the last borehole was a good one. Move a kilometer west. How does a geologist survive like that? I rebelled against that. I wanted to know what the results were. I wanted to plot them out. I wanted to see what was happening.
Let me come back to a comment that Dennis made about grade control. I had a fantastic experience at Rasimoni. When we were building the mine, or the mine was progressing, obviously tonnage was critical. and getting to a steady state tonnage was being driven really, really hard. And of course, we were involved in trying to keep the grade under control at the same time. And one of the miners was making the record every single month on centares, but his stope control was the worst by far. So we challenged him that he was using development steel in the panel. And of course, he denied it flatly. And that continued for a very long time. And then just before he retired, we convinced him to become a grade control officer. And we learned that that's exactly what he had been doing. And of course, from then on, no one else had secrets.
I want to come in on something that all three of us have had a lot to do with, and that was core logging. Core logging was very tedious when I began. It was all paper-based, and you had secretaries typing the things out. Then they came back to you 2 months later, and you had to go back to the core and check that what they'd typed was what you had interpreted the rock as being. And I puzzled myself with this. We needed to have some form of electronic logging system. I think in 81, 82, we traveled to the United States, and I bought my first laptop over there. And I brought it back and started. There was a freeware software package for core logging. It was meant for academics, but it worked pretty well for what we needed. And that was my first attempt at trying to convince management in what was then Amplats. I think we drifted out of JCI into Amplats at that stage, that computers had a place not only in the office, but in the field, and that from that, a logging system needed to be built, and that system had to be common across the bushveld, because properties were going to change hands. Properties would be bought and sold and traded. And if databases of geological information were to be comparable between Northam, Sibanye, Amplats, whatever it is, then the database into which the data is compiled needed to be as consistent as possible across the bushveld. And I think that was probably a big step forward that we made. There was a package that we sponsored the development of, and it standardized many of the terms, because although we had five mines, the same rock was being called four different things across the five mines, and it needed to be standardized.
Only four different things, not five or six.
And the acronyms for pyroxenite, it's PYX or PYR or
PYT.
PYT, there's many, many pyroxenites.
Both Dennis and Ken are nodding vigorously as Gordon's talking, so I think they agree with him.
An interesting one about the core logging and being a mine geologist. So when I was at Union Section, we were responsible for the surface drilling as well. And of course, surface drilling just goes on in the background. And when you're an underground geologist, you're spending almost every day underground. So your time is quite precious when you get to surface in the afternoon. So we would every few days or once a week go out to the drill rig, collect the core, neatly pack it in the core yard. And the core yard at Richard Shaft was actually quite small. I don't know whether you remember it, Gordon. And we laid out these holes, and there was no space for anything else. But we didn't have time to actually do the logging. So we just kept on going and kept on going. And then fatefully, the miners decided to go on strike. So I spent the next 2 weeks logging all the surface boreholes. I got to the end of it thinking, I'm going to get a bit of a break. And they came back to work.
Here's a question. Does anybody enjoy core logging?
I still dabble a little bit in it, but not more over inspection and having a look at it. But talking about core logging, when I was at Zondereinde as chief geologist over there in around about 1997, on a daily basis, I used to go and log core with my team. And I think it was, maybe I was operating at the wrong level there, but I still enjoyed logging core and that you knew what was actually happening ahead of the face. So that was one of the important things. And even today, It's always good to see the core because it puts things in perspective. You know, you can look at a log, a paper log, and you can try and make out what's happening. But when you see the core and you see the broken up formations, you actually have a better feel for what's happening.
I had a fantastic experience when doing due diligences. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we insist on is actually looking at the core. So one of the projects that I was involved in, and it's not for confidentiality reasons, but completely because of old age, I can't remember which project. But they laid out a requisite number of intersections, and they gave me the logs and just the part where Marensky and UG2 were. And we started going through them. And obviously, you're looking at seeing where the grade is and which lithologies and where the chrome is and all those sort of things. So we're just going through this systematically. And in the middle of this, I suddenly looked at one of the intersections and looked at the reference to the thickness on the paper and looked in the core, and the two were different. And it was the bottom chrome, which is obviously the most important because that one bears the highest grade. So there was a bit of a frenzy, which is not unusual, that this was a mistake. This was a tragedy. And after that, they pulled out every single intersection and couldn't find another mistake.
Dennis mentioned something interesting there that's got my mind going, and that is around the statistics and the need to understand the variability of the ore body over the strike and the dip of the mine. And that led us to a program where every borehole that we drilled got at least two wedges on each of the reefs, if we were drilling both Marensky and UG2, and sometimes three wedges, with the idea that within the short range of a wedge, you wanted to understand the short range statistical variability, and between holes, you wanted to understand the variability. But more importantly, one of the wedges would be retained for mineralogical and metallurgical test work so that the plants would know well ahead of the time what the mineralogy was doing and what the mineral assemblage containing BGEs would be like in the future at down dip and along strike. And that led to geotyping and facies delineation and all sorts of interesting things, which I think was a great exercise, and it was wonderful to have the team working on these things.
So Krautfontein is immediately north of the Pilansberg, so between the Pilansberg and Union section. So Gordon had drilled a whole lot of holes there and discovered the Marensky and UG2. But at that stage, for whatever reason, they decided to sink a trial shaft. So they sank a 70-meter shaft, and they I'm not sure how, whether it was manhandled or decree from above, managed to get the union geologists and their teams to go and do the sampling of the Marensky Reef. So the intention was to mine about 350 meters north and south, and we were then every day went in there, and I think we sampled every 5 meters on both sides. It was absolutely fantastic experience doing it. The tragedy was that we closed it, and it was reopened a few times. And my last communication was that some mining guy went and decided that below the grade line had to be whitewashed.
Because the ore body seemed so variable, and I could not draw consistent contours that satisfied myself that we were dealing with a planar ore body. It appeared to be all over the place, and we needed to go and explore that to establish whether it was all over the place. And yeah, that's pretty much what it was.
The longer one's been in platinum, the more one understands the need for understanding geological variability. And I know grade variability is an important aspect as well. But what makes a mine and what doesn't make a mine? And continuity of your reef horizon is paramount. So it's affected by pinching out, attenuation, potholes, all those features that affect it. But the understanding of the geology and the going back and looking at the short-range variability, which you don't often have when your boreholes are spaced hundreds of meters apart. So, you know, you might think you've got continuity because the Bushveld is more or less uniform and conformable. But it's that local swelling and rolling and the effect of shear zones in the hanging wall. All of these are features that affect a mine. And in the words of, I think his name was Chris Shepherd, one of the executives at Lonmin said at one of the coaching sessions, just remember, ore body is king. That is the most important aspect on whether a mine makes it or doesn't make it.
I seem to have all the stories today. But anyway, I remember a really interesting experience. It was on Theresa, when Theresa, before Theresa was a mine, and they were looking for investors. So they managed to get some Chinese to come along. And of course, there was a discussion about what the mine was and where the reef was and all this sort of thing. And everything was being translated. So it was a little bit of an interesting discussion. And so one of the questions that one of the Chinese asked was, where's the geophysics? And we all looked at each other as if, what do you need to do geophysics for? We know where we're going. The things are so consistent that we can predict them remarkably accurately.
Yeah, there's a yes and a no to that. We had the Staildrift project, which down dip of Rasamani, and we knew from mapping on Impala that there was a shear zone and a fault zone that was heading towards the Pilansberg out of Impala's property. But our drilling density was not telling us where this thing was. And I managed to convince, they were on the point of citing a 2 billion rand shaft position. And I said, I can't support this. I haven't got sufficient information. I need to do 3D seismics over this zone. And this was argued about for several days, if not weeks. And eventually I got a 5 kilometer by 3 kilometer 3D seismic survey approved over the potential shaft site. I can tell you that it would have been an absolute disaster had we sunk the shaft where the intended shaft was going to be. It was smack bang where this fault was going to come through. From that day onwards, the Anglo changed, I think we were already Anglo by then, attitude. No shaft will be sighted unless there is adequate 3D seismic surveys. And on Rustenburg Platz, we ended up doing three seismic surveys, one at a low density, which showed up very significant issues in certain areas. And these were then done at much higher levels in successive surveys. So yes, seismic surveys became part of the toolbox that geologists got. In addition to various other things like downhole surveys, which helped a lot in defining shaft strength and shaft stability of the surrounding rocks in the immediate vicinity of a potential shaft.
Gordon, to that, the western limb of the Bushveld was much more amenable to doing the 3D seismic surveys because of the terrain. You know, it was generally more flat. But there is a bit of an absence on the eastern limb in general of 3D surveys that I'm aware of. Maybe towards the north it might have been a bit easier, but when you get into that Dobrochen, Booysendal, Two Rivers area with that mountainous terrain, it becomes a lot more difficult to conduct a 3D survey. But I just getting back to your story, I concur with the findings as well. When I arrived at Lonmin, the down-dip Sharpcrawl area had a couple of very deep boreholes in the depth of about 2,000 meters. And I set off to do the structural model. I thought, you know, some nice set of data. And all I could work out was that it was complex, you know, and I got the structure horribly wrong, but I knew that there was complexity. And after they did the 3D seismic survey, you could not believe the change in interpretation. Everything became much clearer. You had horsts and grabens and amazing what it can do. And one of the things would be nice these days is to be able to start another project. Now, I think you might be aware, the Wits University have a funded group called Bugamet. It's the Bushveld Unit and Bushveld Geology and Metallogeny. which is run by Rice Latipov. And one of the projects over there is to actually have a look at the basement and how that relates to, you know, the attenuation or the development of the stratigraphic packages. So the challenge that the industry has now is how do you actually go and access that old data? Because, you know, these data were stored in these like big cassettes or these funny things, and they in old storerooms, and you know, with the new generations of people coming through, a lot of that data seems to have been not misplaced but not traceable. So it's an exciting project that I think in the pipeline to relook at Bushveld seismic data and have a look, you know, not from a mining perspective, but from an academic perspective of how the footwall of the Transvaal rocks influenced the Bushveld.
Gordon, I think you were involved when PTM decided, what was his name, Michael Jones, decided that he wanted to try and target generate to find new platinum deposits.
Yes.
So he pulled together people, and I think, Gordon, you were one of them, and they found 10, I think they found 10 targets that they thought might work. And eventually they settled on one of them, and that became the Waterberg project. So they extended what we knew about the northern limb to towards the Tabazimbi Murchison lineament, a completely new deposit that hadn't been found before. I think there's still potential.
I think kudos goes to having big kahunas there. You had two failed boreholes that went down best part of 1,000 meters, if not more, and didn't intersect anything, and you decided you're going to go for the third one. I mean, that takes big kahunas. And that one hit.
Absolutely.
Hit bingo. And hats off to Mark Jones and Frank Hallam and the team. Tase Puerto is no longer with us. They did a sterling job of firstly finding it. And I remember Mike Jones coming down to Impala, and he sat here on my deck and said, "Bring out the best bottle of wine you've got. I want you to see something." And we hauled out a bottle of wine, and we sat on the deck and we had a glass of it. And he hauled out of a bag a piece of core from that ore body, and he said, "What is it? Tell me." And I said, "It's Marinsky. It looks like Marinsky. It smells like Marinsky. It assays like Marinsky. It's probably Marinsky."
And you predicted the grade, Gordon?
I don't know that I predicted the grade, but we had at least
come on.
We had at least one bottle of wine on that one, and it's a great team that they've got there working on that. I haven't been involved for a while with that project. I'd love to get back to it at some point in time. I've often used the analogy to a pile of dinner plates, the dinner plates being some 300 odd kilometers across, but very consistent. So, for example, in the Eastern Bushveld, when the very early drilling holes a kilometer apart, I could predict within half a meter of my intersection depth for both Marinsky and UG2, and I'd have a half case of beer on it with the driller as to who was correct. Whether beer comes into this, strangely enough. But yeah, the Bushveld is very, very consistent, unlike many other deposits that I've had the privilege to visit. We are privileged indeed.
But Gordon, adding to that, the consistency is there, but there's always a very subtle cryptic variation that gets us challenged. And you've got to be mindful of how facies changes, as you spoke about earlier, how that affects mining cuts. So the macro picture is kind of consistent, but the smaller, sometimes subtle changes that one has to look out for.
Yeah, absolutely. And it comes down to developing models, trying to understand where the model boundaries are going to be and what are the critical features that define the model boundaries. Right in the beginning, everything was done by the surveyors. Geologists weren't allowed to develop a geological model. Goodness gracious me. And we had to take it away and start building electronic models and then put sophistication to them as data points increased.
I think over time, the geological complexity necessitated the handover of the resource modeling and by geology rather than staying with the survey profession. Even though the surveyors were pretty good at what they did, but the complexity had increased.
I think one of the fascinating things is that geology still counts.
Hmm.
If you don't understand the structure and you don't understand the facies and you don't understand where the mineralization is, don't bother. And I often say to my clients, if you don't get the geology right, don't bother to do an estimate. And these domains or facies or whatever you call them, if you get those right, and Lonmin has had four or five across strike, all the mines, almost all the mines have had different facies. And then you get the potholes. I mean, the potholes have been a fantastic and unusual thing in the Bushveld. I had the privilege at Union Section, there's a pothole, a giant pothole, we call it the mega pothole, that I think is 1.2 by about 900 meters and about 120 meters deep. And they developed across it, and then we start developing from the middle of it out. And it was fascinating to see how the Marinsky was different within it. So there's still lots and lots of geology to do.
Yeah. The cryptic variations, I mean, remind me when I was sampling, you know, Marinsky, at that point it was every 2 centimeters or so with the cryptic variation, as Dennis was mentioning. Now, back to potential, specifically within now the Bushveld, which all you gentlemen have worked on. Now, we've got the various innovations, tools. We've got, you know, there's reasonable geological, great continuity. And Ken knows this well, the reasonable prospects for maybe let's grab the eventual but economic extraction. And this is question comes from the Precious Metals Day that GSSA hosted in 2021, where Dennis delivered a presentation on the interesting project he's working on now. What is the inventory or the resources reserves remaining? I know there's a lot of things. There's upturns, downturns, as Gordon was saying. But you know what is that number? I'm just testing whether you were listening to one of those presentations.
I think the number that I looked at, and I stand to correction on the Western Bushveld, or in total, there's about 50 years at current platinum production rates of around about 6 million ounces a year. So there's about 50 years of mining in reserve. That's current mines. It seems a little bit excessive. But I stand to correction, but that's the number that I just recall at the back of my head. I know it goes up to, what is it? It'll be about 2070. So if you take 6 million ounces being mined every year, well, it wouldn't all be from South Africa. So let's say you have 4 million ounces.
Well, we produce, what, 70%?
So you should have about 200 million ounces in reserve for all the companies together.
Well, I think that you're being quite conservative.
Okay.
I think the economics and everything will change, and the whole mining industry will change. I mean, my late father had he is in the oil industry, and we're talking about the mid-70s. There was a oil crisis, and one of his comments at that stage was, "We will not be flying after 2000." And of course, we fly more now than we've ever flown before. So I'm pretty sure platinum is going to be identical. We've got at least 50 years in reserve, but I think we're going to mine and continue for a very long time. The grade is going to change. Technology is going to change. I mean, one of the things that I wish somebody would get have the ability to do is take a tailings dam where the grade is somewhere around 0.5 gram per ton and exploit it. I mean, the gold guys, DRD Gold, their head grade is 0.25. Now, imagine if we can take all the slimes dams that are on surface and rehabilitate them and get PGMs out. It would be absolutely mind-boggling.
Now, the recovery's become very challenging at 0.5 gram per ton. So what you find with a lot of companies retreating their tailings to win chrome from it. And that's where they could become quite profitable.
But someone will have to find a step up that improves the recovery.
But coming back to the 50 years of reserves, we're not seeing too many new mines coming on. You know, there's very, very limited. I know Ivanplats are developing a project over there on the Platte Reef. That's got potential.
That's got more than potential.
But
astounding.
Besides that, all the expansion of current mines is more for replacement of depleted reserves rather than new reserves. So we're not seeing new reserves coming on. And I think, you know, the cost of capital and the, you know, some the outlook for PGM prices, you know, remains muted. muted at the moment. But that can change very quickly because I think the battery electric vehicle, you know, is a reality, but I don't think it's going to take effect as quick as people anticipate.
Well, just coming back to the Flat Reef, I mean, the Flat Reef is another one of those that was discovered. I mean, nobody believed that it would happen. And I think they did over 700 kilometers of drilling. If I remember, they had 20 or 30 drill rigs at one time drilling there. And they found something quite unusual. When it gets into production, it's going to cause a major ripple in the industry because they're going to produce and other people who are at depth may not be able to fight them.
And Gordon, now back to you. I mean, you've got the experience, the Great Dyke as well, the Waterberg, and you were talking about bush career. Now, we've segued into now how we'd advise youngsters and how to look at things. Dennis and Ken touched on that. What would your advice be for young Joes trying to get into platinum or how they can look at things differently?
Well, there are two aspects that I think are important here. I think, firstly, getting exposure. So don't be afraid to go to the mines and go underground and spend time understanding what an ore body looks like. You can move into exploration later on in your career, but getting the 3D exposure underground is worth every moment that you can get of it. The second thing, and it leads on to this whole notion about EVs. I'm firmly convinced that fuel cells have a place. And the hydrogen fuel cell, I think, has a prominent place and it may stimulate the market and the platinum market sufficiently. The fad of having the internal combustion engine being out of favor, I think that fad is waning. And I think that we're going to see a resurgence of different internal combustion engines and different fuel cell vehicles coming in, the pure hydrogen vehicles as well as the fuel cell vehicles. Young people must use their imagination. I think Einstein said that logic will get you from A to B, but imagination will get you everywhere. And if you allow young people to have the imagination and to test their imagination, I think that's a great starting point. I'm fascinated by young people suddenly showing an interest in mineralogy and being able to identify a range of minerals that I, at a comparable age, had no clue as to what they were. And yet people say, oh, you're a geologist. I found this. And they'll produce something out of their pockets, which they know all about. And I have to really rack my aged brain about. But I'm fascinated by that. I think there is a resurgence in that knowledge area that is going to open a large market for geology into the future, as well as interplanetary geology.
If we could just stay on topic but move a bit wider, you've all had fascinating careers. And what would you say to your younger self or to a young geologist about building a career?
This would be a new geologist that's just got honors degree and coming out into the industry and says, well, I want to get into platinum. What is in it for me?
Not platinum, just in geology. Career.
We both worked for Goldfields in the mid-80s, it would be. There was a gentleman there, Don Campbell, And Don Campbell was the assistant consulting geologist.
He was the consultant when he employed me.
Okay. So he was an elderly gentleman, but he took the young geologists under his wing. He was like a mentor. And in our first year, we were required to go to, I think, three or four different places, to different operations, to do exploration. And he also had a thing called a colloquium. So every 3 months, all the geologists would get together and they had to present what they knew or what they'd learned or what their project, they had to have a project. And that gave us a real interest over and above the slog of going underground, measuring the faults, saying that the reef is up or down. And that was one of the things I would be advising a young geologist: look beyond the being a mine geologist or being an expert or logging core. There's much more to understanding structure, to understanding the geology, the mineralogy, all of that. Look beyond that. Be fascinated by things.
It's a challenging environment these days because you don't have much mineral exploration in South Africa, to be honest, very limited. But nonetheless, I mean, we were very, very privileged or maybe fortunate in our days that with Goldfields, you were able to move from one commodity to another commodity and get that exposure. But what I am seeing, and I'm going to come back to the platinum space as well, is that you're finding many honors graduates that come into platinum can't get a job as a geologist. But however, they start off as a stope observer. So they pretty clued up in looking at all the face variability. And I think from that perspective is that they need to start looking at things more around understanding it a bit deeper than just this official daily position of what they've seen. And then to start looking a little bit broader than just being a good stope observer or a good mine geologist, become a good bushveld geologist, like Gordon's had privileged and yourself, Ken, to see. And myself, I've seen a little bit, a fraction of what you guys have seen, but you know, you get to see over time, you get to see more and more. But one thing is to try and see more sooner in your career rather than later on in the career. And then the other angle is that I'm seeing more of these days is that geologists are moving out of geology and going into rock engineering because of the mine health and safety regulations. They required a specialist to be at a face within a certain period of time, so the demand is there. And one gap that I've seen, and I'm not an expert on rock engineering modeling, but I understand that fewer and fewer people that actually can do these stress simulation work. That's a very, very limited group of people. So that could be, you know, don't think just geology. Think of the other, like Gordon said, the mineralogy side. Go beyond just the operational control type work and have a look at where you can actually have a little niche rather than just allowing, you know, waiting for the company to appoint you as a geologist and then move up the hierarchy.
And I think one of the areas is geometallurgy. Geometallurgy is a huge thing. I mean, recoveries and understanding the ore body from a mineralogical point of view. And I think that when I started, was it Louis Cabri who put together the sort of first list of PGM minerals? There were a hundred or so. I think now there must be well over 200, and there are many of them that only have been seen once. So they've been discovered, they've been microprobed, and now they are a mineral species, but they've only been seen once. So I think mineralogy, geometallurgy, huge, huge place that we as geologists can have a say and an influence.
I've got a little story about unique minerals. As when I was doing my MSc at Achenes, and there was a green-looking mica, and after doing some microprobe analysis, it turned out it was a barium-rich mica, barium-rich biotite.
Hoffmanite.
No. But here it is. But it was eventually established as a new mineral, and it had the name as kinoshitalite. which doesn't occur too many in many places. But yeah, getting back to the you know, the career development. You know, the other angle is, you know, if you are in the mining side after 5 years of exposure, get more in understanding the business side of the operations, you know, because there's a potential to move, you know, and I think, you know, maybe move on and, you know, do an MBA or get more involved understanding, you know, the business side. Read the annual reports that each mining company puts out, and that'll give you a better understanding and then allow you to move on with your career.
Well, I think one of the things that's fascinating is that geologists on mines in particular are one amongst the few graduates in the system. So we are tend to be the intelligent people around the room. Engineers think that they know better than we do. Yeah. And there's this traditional fight between the engineers and the geologists. But we've got a huge amount that we can bring to the table. So I think that we shouldn't be standing back. We should continue to fight the good fight, particularly with the mining engineers. Well,
you see, geologists have moved into fairly high-level positions within the industry. You know, we had our Brad Mulls, he was a geologist. Cynthia Carroll was a geologist. So a little story goes back to when I was working in Achenes, and we went part of the Namaqualand branch of the Geological Society, and we went across the border post into Namibia at a border post called Onsiepkans. And, you know, a very, very sleepy little border post. And there was one policeman there, and on his desk was law books. And there was a guy, Loki van Skalkwyk. He's still active in that part of the world. And he looked at this and he said, you know, a policeman studying law is like a geologist studying an MBA. Somewhere along the line, he's got hot full and he's moving on. You know? So, you know, those were one of the classic ones. But there's so many of these little places, you know, where in the Namaqualand or in any mining district or exploration district where they just foster a wealth of experiences and stories.
And we haven't even had a joke from Gordon.
Tony Nelvred.
The Nickel Pope and PGE, yeah.
No, just thinking of another name that had a very interesting, influence. Sitting with him and quietly chatting about observations, what a wonderful mind. And there were great people who got involved in igneous petrology. Not just the Bushveld, but he was fascinated by the Bushveld nonetheless. And we were privileged to sponsor him for more than a decade to come out every year, observe, discuss, and then go away and write up. And so it was good to have Tony Nelvred around.
Gordon, do you remember giving Ward Martin a run for his money?
Yeah, absolutely.
So Gordon would phone Ward. So Ward was a really interesting story. So when I went to Union, a mine, Ward had just left, and he left a huge amount of information and allowed me to eventually write a paper on the mega pothole. So we kept in touch over time. And then when I went to Rasimoni, we were looking for a geologist. So I still had his number, so I phoned him. And the story is that he was looking at a trench or something, got my call, and within days was on the mine. Anyway, so he became the elderly gentleman at Rasimoni, and Gordon would phone him, and in his best colloquial accent, ask Ward to wash his car. And he would go on and on and on, and Ward was a gentleman of note and didn't want to put the phone down or swear or anything. And eventually Gordon would let the cat out the bag. And then Ward was spitting mad.
I think one of the characteristics that I would like a geologist to have is the ability to have fun. you don't necessarily have to make fun of people, but you have to have fun in what you're doing. There's an element of enjoyment that you must be able to get from what you're doing, and it's not always enjoyment. Sometimes, and most of the time, it's a slog. But yes, you've got to, at the end of a year, be able to look back and issue the awards for the person who missed the bridge while coming home from the pub or drilled a borehole on the wrong farm. We had various awards. We had the Jewel of Labungu, which was an elephant turd about yay long, mounted on a wooden plank with little brass plikies of the previous recipients. And there was another one called the Blunt Bit, for it was a collection of really stuffed drill bits, suitably mounted again with little brass plikies for the previous recipients. And that was for the geologist who really stuffed it up. He planted the borehole on the wrong farm and had to hand over the core, got the coordinates mixed up and used the X instead of the Y. We also had the Blunt Pick, and you had to be sober when you said that.
And I do remember, Gordon, just before Rasamoni became a mine, we got all the Anglo guys together, and you took us all to Rasamoni, and it was a wet, probably January or February day. So Gordon, with great glee, took everyone into the riverbed to show them where the Marenski Reef outcropped at Rasamoni. And of course, because it was a wet and rainy January or February day, he got stuck. So what he did is he got all his mates who were now on the back of the buggy to start pushing. And then he pushed the accelerator and they all got muddy. And then we all went to lunch, very muddy and cursing and swearing for Gordon, who had made us that way.
I think it was a privilege to be part of a great team of people. There were very few occasions where you had to tell somebody what they needed to do. It became self-evident. We had a program of what should be done. People would say, I want to do that on this project, and you go for it. And we'd find money to make things happen. I thoroughly enjoyed that aspect of it. It became tedious when SAP was introduced and you couldn't order colored pencils without 17 people having to authorize one packet of colored pencils. That was just ridiculous.
One thing that I've picked up that's changed, not on a technical side, but it's on the esprit de corps amongst the geologists on operations. When everybody was living in the same village, you had that closer connection. And what I see these days, people stay in different towns and they come from different areas and commute to work every day. And so you don't have that, not entirely, but there is a element of a different, relationship that you have on the mine. You know, that when you worked on a mine, well, your only friends were the other geologists. So you got on.
I've been very fortunate that I've developed a really good relationship with many of the geologists across the bushveld. And it's fascinating to see that they move from place to place.
Mm.
And then you meet them in a different place.
Mm.
And that sometimes you meet them in a social setting and you have to try and work out who they are and where they fit in into the pile.
Mm.
You do know the order of blame on a mine in terms of the goal, in terms of the grade.
Grade, yeah.
So the metallurgist discovers that he's not getting the grade. So he will blame the mining engineer. And the mining engineer will blame the geologist. So where does the geologist go? He can only blame God.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, this has been absolutely fabulous. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. And for those listening to our podcast, keep an eye out. There'll be another one coming soon.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.